is I tell people, if you're going to inject substances that whose purpose is to make you make antibodies, I mean, what do you expect is going to happen?
Cue music. Places, everybody, places. We're starting in 3, 2.
Welcome to the Autoimmune Hour, where we look at the rise of autoimmune disorders. I've brought together top experts that range from doctors, specialists, nutritionists, researchers, and even those recovering from autoimmune to bring you the latest, most up-to-date information about autoimmunity and how to live your life uninterrupted.
Thank you for joining us here on the Autoimmune Hour with Sharon Saylor. And we don't want you to worry about taking too many notes, so you can join the Autoimmune Hour's Courage Club, and we'll send you the transcripts and show notes from every episode. Sign up now at understandingautoimmune.com. Now, back to your host, Sharon Saylor.
Welcome, everyone, to the Autoimmune Hour, Surviving to Thriving with Sharon Saylor. And it's my pleasure to be with you here again for another brand new episode. I think we're at about 190 now. I was counting backwards there, trying to figure that out. I think we're about at an awesome 190 episodes. When I first started this, I didn't know there was so much to learn about autoimmunity. But the more I get in, the more I realize we're just scratching the surface of understanding autoimmune. And so tonight I have a great guest, Dr. Thomas Cowan, and he studied and written about many subjects in medicine, including nutrition, homeopathy, herbal medicine. And his latest book is called Vaccines, Autoimmunity, and the Changing Nature of Childhood Illness. And as I was reading his book and also through some of his promotional materials, there was a lot of information that startled me. And some of the things that startled me was that in the past 50 years, the chronic health conditions in children like asthma, eczema, digestive disorders, autism have absolutely exploded. 1 in 2.5 children has an allergy, 1 in 11 has asthma, and 1 in 36 has autism. That was just absolutely shocking to me and to my guest who wants to know what's going on. And so that's why he wrote his latest book. So welcome, doctor. Thank you for being on the show.
Thank you. Thank you for having me on your show.
Wow. Those figures are just absolutely startling. Is that what got you into writing your book, Vaccines, Autoimmunity, and the Changing Nature of Childhood Illness, or was there a story behind it?
When I first started in medicine, we're talking 35 years ago, I was trained in something called anthroposophical medicine, which is similar to biodynamics and Waldorf schools. And we were taught and learned about a very particular way of looking at illness, and it relates to how childhood illness needs to be appreciated, understood, and squired. And if that doesn't happen, all kinds of bad things happen. And then the founder of that was a guy named Rudolf Steiner, who actually predicted sort of dire things would happen if children were vaccinated. So 35 years ago, I was interested in the whole subject. And the whole vaccine industry has kind of exploded in the last 30 years. And I guess I just felt it was time to speak up.
Wow. There seems to be so much debate about vaccines, pro and con, and they seem to be quite vitriol on their sides about it, which leaves someone like myself, the average person, really in a conundrum of like, what is true and what isn't true? Plus, I was thinking about when I was young, just a small number of vaccinations, but my grandchildren nowadays seem to be getting many, many more than I ever got. Is that the case, or am I just remembering wrong?
In 1970, there was there was approximately 9 on the official schedule, and now the mandate from the CDC is, it depends a little bit, but it's about 59 different injections between 0 and 18.
59,
and believe it or not, between the ages of 18 and 65, adults are mandated to get 64 injections.
So if I was new this year, I would get 59 before 18 and then another 60 plus in my adulthood?
Or you're 65.
Oh my gosh.
The math, that's 120-ish plus.
Wow.
No adults do that, of course, because everybody ignores the official requirements, although there is an initiative called Healthy 2020 that will make it mandatory for all adults to follow the CDC schedule. It's not passed yet, but interestingly, the department that's going to propose to administer this is the Department of Transportation, which seems weird.
That does totally seem weird. What logic am I missing there? I would hope that they would have some sort of medical training.
But they're the administrators of the program. So if you go to board an airplane and it shows up on your thing that you're not compliant with the vaccine schedule because you didn't get your annual flu shot or your pneumonia vaccine, you could be not allowed to board the airplane or get a driver's license.
Wow, I'm speechless right now. I'm thinking of a lot of people.
Mind you, that hasn't passed yet. So
right, but even if it's being considered, I'm speechless because a lot of people with autoimmune, especially when it's in a what we call a flare, are advised about not getting vaccines right at that time because they don't want to assault the system anymore. When I was at the height of my autoimmune, I was told there were certain ones, you know, let's just wait a little bit on those. And I can't imagine being denied transportation on a flight just because, for whatever reason, I can't get a particular vaccine, even if it's on some sort of personal grounds.
Right. Well, we'll see.
Wow. Okay. You've left me a little bit speechless there. Let's talk a little bit about this idea of what is the latest research on vaccines. Like I said, if you read, of course, you know, I like to call it Dr. Google, it can take you any and everywhere, and it just leaves the average person completely confounded.
If I could give your listeners a overview of how I came to decide that there is a connection between vaccines and autoimmune disease, I think you'll see then the situation. And then I'm, of course, not the only one who's made this connection. So I think if we do that, we'll put the whole thing in context and then we can sort of go from there.
Awesome. Let's jump in.
So the main thing I tell people, including patients, which I've over the years, so I've been, for a family doctor for 35 years, and you know, the truth of the matter is over that time, I've probably given people 10 tetanus shots, and that's about it. So I've been a under-vaccinator, if you want to, for 35 years. And the upshot of that is I've seen hundreds of cases of, you know, whooping cough and chicken pox. And so I'm familiar with how those manifest and even how to treat those. So what I tell people is we don't have an immune system, we have two immune systems. And they're called the cell-mediated and the humoral, or the humoral is also called the antibody immune system. They're also called TH1 and TH2. So if you take a disease like chickenpox or measles or any other normal viral infection, there's a very specific sequence of events. So the first thing is, if you're so-called naive to the virus, meaning you've never encountered the virus before, the virus will get in and it will infect a number of cells, some thousands of cells, usually in your respiratory tract and other places. So you have now these thousands of virally infected cells, and the body wants to get rid of them, and it uses a cell-mediated, i.e. a white blood cell response, to essentially go in and digest and excrete those infected cells from the body. The important point to realize about the cell-mediated reaction is that the cell-mediated reaction, which typically takes 7 to 10 days, is what we call being sick. And In fact, there's an important distinction here. It's not the chickenpox virus that makes you sick. It's the chickenpox virus that stimulates a cell-mediated reaction, and it's the cell-mediated reaction that makes you sick. A lot of other things that can stimulate a cell-mediated reaction, like poison ivy, for instance. And so there's different variations of the cell-mediated reaction. But basically, what we know is that the cell-mediated reaction is what makes you, quote, sick. And so how do we know that? We know that because you can use chemicals to stimulate a cell-mediated reaction, and the person will be sick, meaning cold, fever, flu-like symptoms, mucus, cough, rash, all the things we associate with being sick. On the other hand, you can infect somebody with a virus, give them prednisone to suppress their cell-mediated reaction, and they won't be sick. They could actually die of the infection, but they won't actually be what we call sick. So it's very clear that what we call sick is the reaction of the cell-mediated immune system. And the purpose of that immune system is to clear the virus or whatever else is setting it off and the infected cells out of the body. And it does that through elimination channels. It does that through fever. It does that through rashes, mucus, cough, all the rest of the things we call sick. So that takes 7 to 10 days. And then the body doesn't want to do the same sickness over and over again, because if there wasn't any other plan, you would just keep getting measles or chickenpox or mumps or whatever over and over again. So there's a memory arm, which is called the humoral or antibody arm. And what that does is it isolates and tags a certain part of the viral capsule, a protein, or the bacteria or the toxin, and it makes antibodies to that part, to that unique part that tags that as a measles virus, and then the antibodies essentially thwart that virus from infecting cells from then on, and so no cell-mediated reaction has to happen from then on. And the important points are two. One is there is no visible signs or symptoms of a humoral reaction happening. You don't feel sick, you don't feel anything, you just make antibodies. And number two, when both of those happen in sequence, which is essentially the only way that humans have gotten sick until recently, they get a virus, they get a cell-mediated reaction, then they get a humoral reaction, and then they are immune for life. And it's an incredibly reliable and foolproof system, so that the number of times that a person will get chickenpox or measles twice is almost zero. It just never happens. If you have a cell-mediated and then a humoral, you're immune for life. So that's the theory of how an immune system works. And again, it could be a virus, a bacteria, a toxin, you know, formaldehyde, whatever you have to eliminate goes through those stages. Now, along the way, we decided that the cell-mediated is not good for us, and we should bypass that and stimulate people to make antibodies without having to go through a prior cell-mediated reaction. That, in a nutshell, is the theory of vaccines. So we have measles. We say the cell-mediated part, that's a problem. It kills people, it makes them sick, you know. The fact of the matter is, it rarely kills people in the modern era, and even decades before there was vaccines, the death rate from, say, measles was almost zero in this country. But anyways, it's inconvenient and you're sick, and so our goal is to prevent sickness. So we're going to bypass the cell-mediated immune system and just stimulate an antibody response. That is the goal of the vaccines. Now, when they did that, if you take like tetanus toxoid and you put that with saline and you inject it into a person, then nothing happens. No antibodies, no immune reaction. No antibodies are made. So you can't do that. You have to mix it with something that's called an adjuvant, which means helper, which is a friendly sounding word. An adjuvant is something that essentially poisons the immune system, or let's be more clear about it, stimulates the antibody part of the immune system to make antibodies. Now, the adjuvants that are used in vaccines are not specific to, so if you put a measles virus in an adjuvant, you're not going to just make antibodies to the measles virus. Like, that doesn't happen. Nobody says it does. The adjuvants just stimulate you to make antibodies, and because it's mixed with tetanus toxoids or measles or mumps or diphtheria or part of the pertussis, you do make antibodies to those bacteria or toxins. But you also make antibodies to anything else that's around. So essentially, you know, people always ask, why do they put this crap, excuse my French, vaccines? Why don't they just put saline and harmless preservative and measles? The answer is because it doesn't work. No antibodies are made. You have to put things like aluminum, formaldehyde, thimerosal, dead fetal DNA, antifreeze, glyphosate, all this stuff in there to essentially irritate the immune system into making antibodies. So then you do it, maybe in the old days we did it 3 times, and then we did it 9 times. Now we do it 59 times, including sometimes 2 months old get doses of adjuvants in 9 different injections all at once. The purpose of it is to stimulate antibody production. I can't be more clear about that. And because I have a little bit of a smart alecky tendency, I'm told, I sometimes say to people, well, maybe it works. Works means you now put the person in a high antibody state. Now, for instance, back when I was in elementary school, there was nobody with peanut allergies. There are peanut proteins in some of the vaccines. So if you inject somebody with a substance, like aluminum in particular, that's there to make you make antibodies, and you put peanut proteins in the same vial, you would expect that some of the people are going to start making antibodies to peanut proteins. And in which case, if they eat them, they're going to overreact. And that's, I think, the genesis and the etiology of the peanut allergy epidemic that we have. If you look at what is the definition of an autoimmune disease, let's take Hashimoto's or rheumatoid arthritis. The definition is the person is in a high antibody state. With Hashimoto's, they're making thyroid peroxidase or thyroglobulin antibodies more than they should. With rheumatoid arthritis, they're making rheumatoid factor more than they should. If you ask an endocrinologist or a rheumatologist, why are they making so many antibodies? They say they don't know. It's idiopathic, unknown etiology. But if you think about it, the purpose of the vaccine state is to stimulate you over and over and over again to be in a high antibody state. And like I say, maybe it works. And so then if you have some thyroid proteins hanging around because of inflammation of your thyroid, you will make thyroid antibodies, and that sets off the vicious cycle known as Hashimoto's. So it's very clear. Now, I just want to, if you don't mind, I want you to read you something, because obviously I didn't make this up by myself. I mean, I put it in a certain context. But there's a guy named Yehuda Schoenfeld. He's the editor-in-chief of Autoimmune Reviews. He's the editor of the Israeli Medical Association Journal. He's the editor-in-chief of Autoimmunity Review, the co-editor of the Journal of Autoimmunology, member of the editorial board of Clinical Reviews in Allergy and Immunology. He's written.
He seems to have the credentials.
My point is, he probably knows something about autoimmune disease.
Yes.
He says, quote, throughout our lifetime, the normal immune system walks a fine line between preserving normal immune reactions and developing autoimmune disease. The healthy immune system is tolerant to self-antigens. When self-tolerance is disturbed, dysregulation of the immune system follows, resulting in emergence of autoimmune disease. Vaccination is one of the prime conditions that disturbs this homeostasis in individuals, resulting in autoimmune phenomena and ASIA. ASIA stands for autoimmune syndrome induced by adjuvant. Adjuvant means the aluminum and all the other things that are put into the vaccines. And he estimates there's 150 million plus people in the world, who are suffering from ASIA, which interestingly enough is going to be renamed the Schoenfeld syndrome. So it's good for him, I guess.
We need to take a quick commercial break, Dr. Cowan. We'll be right back, guys. This is absolutely fascinating to me, and I want to know more about ASIA, soon to be renamed. I find that so fascinating because there again, I've read about both sides, some saying that doesn't exist and others saying it does. So we'll get into that debate in just a minute. We need to take a quick commercial break, Dr. Cowan. We'll be right back, guys.
Life Interrupted Radio will return after these messages from our sponsors. It's great sponsors like these that keep this show coming to you every week. Be sure and stop by lifeinterruptedradio.com to learn more.
Your conscious lifestyle on steroids. OM Times Radio, IOM FM.
Hello, I'm Lisa Berry. Join me every Monday at 1 p.m. Eastern Time for Light on Living, a chance to see new, hear different, and feel more as I shine the spotlight on all the ways to lighten the load of life's challenges. Light on Living is your link to that new way you're looking for, that new understanding that will enhance your life, and that positive connection that will support your growth. So join me, and you'll gain insight and start to see things in a new way that motivates you.
OM Times Magazine is one of the leading online content providers of positivity, wellness, and personal empowerment. A philanthropic organization, their net proceeds are funneled to support worldwide charity initiatives via Humanity Healing International. Through their commitment to creating community and providing conscious content, they aspire to uplift humanity on a global scale. OM Times. Co-creating a more conscious lifestyle.
Listen and imagine. It takes 5 seconds to send a text, and for those 5 seconds, you're driving blind.
Life is worth more than a text.
Stay alive. Don't text and drive.
Visit StopTextStopWrecks.org, a message brought to you by the National Highway Traffic Safety Administration, Project Yellow Light, Noise, and the Ad Council.
Hi, this is Sharon, and of course you know me from here on the Autoimmune Hour. Maybe you don't know I'm also an author. My latest book is for kids. It's Pinky Chenil and the Rainbow Hunters, a winner of a 5-star reader's favorite review. It's perfect for your early reader and a great bedtime story for your young adventurers. Check it out over at pinkychenille.com. That's PinkyChenille.com. See you there. Welcome back, everyone, to the Autoimmune Hour, Surviving to Thriving. And we're here with Dr. Thomas Cowan, and he is the author of the new book, Vaccines, Autoimmunity, and the Changing Nature of Childhood Illness. And he's been sharing with us things I've never heard before. I'm absolutely just gobstopped here with this, finding out all of this. And as we had to take that quick commercial break, he shared with us this idea of the acronym ASIA. So Dr. Cowan, let's jump back in right there and describe, how do they know that it's by these and not just, you know, coincidence?
Well, one of the ways is there was a study at Kyoto University where they took, I believe it was dogs, and they decided to vaccinate them until they had signs of an autoimmune disease. And they could find the dose that produced autoimmune disease in 80 to 90% of the dogs. So one of the ways that medicine and doctors find out the etiology of a disease, because you can't really do that with humans, is to do it on animals. And if you find that you can recreate a disease by a certain intervention, that's a very good proof of causation. And so we have that. The reference to that is in my book. And we have probably 100 peer-reviewed articles documenting the existence of ASIA, in other words, autoimmune syndrome induced by adjuvant. And as I tell people, if you're going to inject substances that whose purpose is to make you make antibodies, I mean, what do you expect is going to happen?
What's their response? I mean, this seems common sense the way you're describing it. I can't imagine there would be a lot of argument. I mean, injecting anything into your body, you know, you're going to get some response.
I mean, if you look at aluminum, which is the main adjuvant that's used and probably the most responsible for a lot of these troubles, you know, you have the second most ubiquitous substance on Earth. I think silica is number one. You have, as far as we know, no biological organism uses aluminum for any reaction. Unlike zinc, you know, we use zinc for certain things. We use iron, we use magnesium. We use most of the common metals or elements because, you know, we're part of nature and we use what's available, just like anybody does. But apparently there's no biological reaction that is able to use aluminum. And because of that, we have very low absorption of aluminum. It's about 0.02%. So if you have a child and they go and eat a bunch of sand, that may not be good for them, but they don't absorb any aluminum from that because the absorption is so low because we don't use it, so the body doesn't absorb it. And because of that, we don't have any excretion pathways for it. We don't use it, we don't absorb it. Therefore, there's no sense in evolutionarily developing all these pathways to get rid of it because we don't absorb it in the first place. As I tell my patients, if you've run into a substance like that, my advice to them is the last thing you want to do is inject that into your body. But that's why we do it. We do it because it is a very effective, potent stimulant of antibody production.
Well, I've got a quick question about aluminum, though. I've read research studies, and I'm not an expert on this. I'm just a thriving patient. Isn't there studies out there about aluminum and dementia and aluminum and leaky gut and aluminum causing, I guess, sort of finding its own way about the body, since we have no way of explaining
aluminum
it?
Causes all kinds of troubles. Because the way that we have to excrete it is essentially by developing inflammatory response to it. We don't have normal excretion pathways. So if you go and inject somebody with aluminum, you've got a problem because you don't know how to excrete it. So you have to create some sort of abnormal, toxic, you know, inflammatory reaction, whether in the bowel or in the brain. And so you end up with that causing disease, like Alzheimer's or irritable bowel, et cetera. So you ask, so what's the argument against this? So they use very disingenuous arguments saying there's more aluminum in breast milk than there is in a vaccine. So that's one argument. The other argument is the dose of aluminum is safe according to the CDC or the FDA over these 2 months. Now let me dissect these a little bit. The first thing is comparing it to orally presented aluminum is completely disingenuous because, as I said, we know that oral aluminum doesn't get absorbed. Comparing injectable parenteral aluminum to a dose that's orally absorbed is frankly ridiculous. So that argument is ridiculous. The second argument that the way they do it, it's like if you get, just to use a number, 1 milligram of aluminum on day one from a vaccine, and the toxic dose is 0.1. So they say, well, you only get one vaccine every 2 months. So the daily dose of aluminum is 1 divided by 30, which is lower than the 0.1 daily, you know, toxic level.
That's not how I learned to do math.
Well, no, it's true, because if it was over 2 months, it would be a daily dose of 1 milligram divided by 60 days. So it would be whatever.
Yeah, but didn't they just give it to me in one dose, one day? Dose.
Right. And so it isn't fine. You're right. Giving it all at once is totally different. And anyways, most doctors and most researchers either don't know the literature or ignore it or have reasons why they just don't want to acknowledge this. But, you know, there's all kinds of books. There's Miller's review of 400 studies in peer-reviewed journals documenting the phenomena of Asia, the connection with autoimmune disease. There is so much literature in the peer-reviewed journal backing what I say. A lot of it is in my book. Anyways, if you want to know the other opinion, you have to ask somebody who has another opinion.
I am just curious, though, with that much research, why are we going from just a few vaccines to, as you said, 59 until 18, and then not the same amount when we're an adult? My goodness, I guess I'm confused why there isn't more debate about it and why it's becoming mandatory when there's research showing that, you know, maybe we need to stop and look at this a little bit deeper.
Well, there's a whole possible range of reasons. And again, I don't want to speak for other people, so they have their reasons. I can tell you, though, that there's some history is, I think, shocking for many people. And that is, this thing started in 1986. So here's what happened. So they were using a very toxic form of pertussis vaccine, causing thousands of brain injured, basically inflammatory reaction in the brain, children. And the vaccine manufacturers were getting sued to the point where their business was becoming unviable. So they went to Congress, and Reagan was president at the time, and said, we're going to stop making vaccines unless you indemnify us in perpetuity against any damages from vaccines. In other words, this had never happened before in the history of the United States or any other Western country that I know of. There may be some, but I don't know of it. Where for the first time, you know, the usual check and balance, if somebody makes a defective chair, you sue the manufacturer, and then they don't want to get sued, so they make a better chair. So for the first time in the history of U.S. business, a manufacturer of a product got blanket immunity. So in other words, this 1986 vaccine compensation law that Reagan reluctantly signed, sort of to his credit and to his detriment, he signed it. And so from then on, if a vaccine was on the schedule by the CDC, you can't sue the manufacturer. And the country, the Department of Justice, was set up a vaccine compensation court so that if you were injured from a vaccine, you had the right to sue the Department of Justice, believe it or not. Our own attorney general defends or is on the other side of you. And without any discovery, period, so you can't search the literature, you can't present the research, but you can be awarded up to $250,000 lifetime damages for injury from a vaccine. So you had a situation at that point where if the manufacturers could make it a vaccine, they get it on the schedule. If they got it on the schedule, then every American had to buy it, and they had no liability for damages because that was covered by the U.S. government. At that point, it became the best deal in town. I mean, who wouldn't want to have a company that the government forces you to buy it and you can't be held responsible? And I just found out this week that they did put in a provision saying the Health and Human Services, which oversaw the law, had to report to the Congress every 2 years on updating the safety and efficacy of the vaccines since then. Bobby Kennedy did a Freedom of Information Act against them. It turns out they never once filed a report in all these 32 years updating or saying anything about the safety or efficacy of the vaccines. So essentially, we have a situation where people are forced to buy their product. They have no liability if it doesn't work or if it injures people. They have nobody looking at them to see whether they're safe or effective. It's a great business, so they went with it. Now, since then, you get different numbers, but I think the current number is $3.9 billion of damages have been paid out by the Department of Justice or the U.S. government against vaccine-damaged people. So there's a lot of vaccine-damaged people. They estimate, the CDC estimates, that that's somewhere between 0.1 and 1% of the people who are actually injured have gotten compensation, because it's so hard to prosecute your case, as you can imagine. And the vaccine reporting laws are horrible and ineffective, and nobody uses them. So if it's, say, 1%, which is very conservative, that means the government at this point would be on the hook for $400 billion of damages, which means it's a kind of an existential problem for the government. It's like anybody. You can't now admit you were wrong, because how are you going to pay all that money? And what are you going to do with all those people? And are we going to repeal the law? I mean, we don't have any other product that has such a situation. And is that the reason why there's so many more vaccines? I mean, every other product made by a drug company has to go through double-blind testing. Vaccines don't have to do any of that. Like, Vioxx killed 50,000 people, and they eventually got sued. And you can't do that with vaccines.
If we look at other, like Western Europe or other countries, Canada, what number of vaccines do they have, and how do they approach vaccines?
They have about a third to a half as are required by the United States, depending on which country. But they more or less approach them the same. They have the same, in my opinion, bogus numbers on how many lives vaccines have saved. Whereas if you actually look at the CDC is required every decade and every century, the end of the century, to report on the number of deaths from each infectious disease. 95 to 99% of the decrease in death rate from tetanus and mumps and pertussis and measles and et cetera came before the vaccine due to whatever, public health measures. In the most dramatic case is the death rate from measles in 1953, which was 10 years before the vaccine was introduced in 63. Was basically zero. And so the interesting question is, why didn't we celebrate the fact that just basically letting people have measles, strengthening their immune system, essentially supporting their cell-mediated immune system so they don't end up with autoimmune disease, they don't end up with allergies, they don't end up with peanut problems, and because we give them a little vitamin A and we just don't let, you know, feces run in the street and we have refrigeration and more or less clean-ish environments, we eradicated the problem of dying from measles. Rather than celebrating that, we embarked on this kind of nutty campaign, which not nutty from a financial point of view for certain interests, but for the rest of it, it was kind of nuts.
We need to take a quick commercial break, Dr. Cowan. We'll be right back, guys.
Life Interrupted Radio will return after these messages from our sponsors. It's great sponsors like these that keep this show coming to you every week. Be sure and stop by lifeinterruptedradio.com to learn more.
Your conscious lifestyle on steroids. OM Times Radio. IOM FM.
Change and growth are part of natural life and also part of your spiritual life. Everyone needs support and guidance, especially during life passages. Upgrade yourself with the OM Times Experts program. With OM Times Experts, you have access to the best intuitive coaches, spiritual teachers, counselors, astrologists, and oracles. Our team was carefully selected so you can trust. Find out more at experts.omtimes.com.
Grab a cup of tea or a glass of wine and tune in for Inspired Conversations with publisher Linda Joy on Tuesdays at 2 p.m. Eastern. Linda creates sacred space for leading female luminaries, empowering authors, heart-centered female entrepreneurs, coaches, and healers. A soulful venue where guests openly share the fears and obstacles they've overcome, wisdom and lessons learned, and the personal journey that led them to the transformational work they do in the world. Inspired Conversations to empower you on your path to authentic, soulful living.
Research shows we apologize up to 10 times a day, and most of the time, we say sorry as a response to someone else's mistake. What if we thanked people instead of all that unnecessary apologizing? So instead of saying, sorry, I'm rambling, you say, thank you for listening. Join us at projectforgive.com, a free non-religious resource on global forgiveness.
Welcome back, everyone, to the Autoimmune Hour, Surviving to Thriving. And we're here with Dr. Thomas Cowan, and he is the author of the new book, Vaccines, Autoimmunity, and the Changing Nature of Childhood Illness. And he's been sharing with us things I've never heard before. You also talk about in the book about the origins of autoimmune. And I know you talk about it in the vaccines and how it starts in the gut. Let's jump over to this about the origins of autoimmune, and then also want to just a few things that maybe we can do to strengthen our systems if we already have autoimmune.
So an autoimmune disease is accelerated antibody production, right? We've established that. So the question is, what are the antigens that are stimulating the antibodies to be produced? Now, you know, I'm trained as a medical doctor, but I don't obviously believe everything I learned. But the fact that there are antibodies, I do believe that's true. You can test it in the blood. The problem is the antibodies, even though they cause inflammatory destruction of your tissues, they cause damage. And I want to be very careful to explain this. They're not the problem. It's a bit like if you get a splinter in your finger, you make pus. Pus causes pain and swelling and can even destroy your tissue. But the pus is the response to the splinter. And so getting rid of the pus will never solve the problem. Now, I'm not saying that sometimes getting rid of the pus is not a good thing. It is. But ultimately, you have to get rid of the splinter. The splinter, in the case of autoimmune disease, is that which provokes you to make antibodies. Because don't get me wrong, I want the people to stop making antibodies too. But I want them to stop making antibodies because we pull the splinter out and you don't need pus anymore. And so what's the splinter in autoimmune disease? There's basically three. One is infections, which stimulate you to make antibodies. In fact, interestingly, back in the 30s, we thought syphilis was an autoimmune disease. Then we found out there was a bacteria, and the body was making antibodies to try to clear the spirochete, and it was just not effective enough, and so it kept going. As soon as you get rid of the spirochete with penicillin, the whole thing stops because you essentially pull the splinter out. So that's one cause of antibodies is infection. Another is you're leaking proteins from the gut into the bloodstream, so-called leaky gut or inflammatory bowel disease. And those antigens lead you to make antibodies, particularly in the Peyer's patches, which are the antibody factories around the intestines. And the third is vaccines, which directly stimulate you to make antibodies. And most people have some component of all those. They have some infections, they have inflamed gut, and they have vaccines, which sometimes are causing both of the first two. So most people have some component of that with an autoimmune disease. And the therapy is a low antigen diet, help the gut, seal the gut, and rebalance the immune system. And I basically do that with, you know, an autoimmune type of diet like the GAPS diet or paleo, autoimmune paleo diet or nourishing traditions. I outline the details in the book. I use a medicine called Restore to seal the gut so the antigens don't leak. And I use low-dose naltrexone, which down-regulates the humoral and up-regulates the cell-mediated immune system, which is chronically out of balance because of those reasons.
Right. Now, low-dose naltrexone has just been recently come, I mean, no, I know the drug has been around for a long time, but it's just recently come into the area of autoimmune, correct? We don't hear a lot about it from many places like rheumatologists and things like that. So let's talk a little bit about what
it's
is
been around since the mid-90s as treatment for autoimmune disease. I've been using it since about 1999. There are studies with fibromyalgia, there are studies with MS, there are studies with Crohn's disease. 68% of Crohn's disease patients went into remission just with low-dose naltrexone, published in the American Journal of Gastroenterology. Why don't rheumatologists use it? You have to ask them.
Wow. I've been reading up on it for a while now. When I first heard about it, only about a year ago, and it was one of those things like so many autoimmune patients find is it's so hard to find the right information or any information to at least even make your own personal decision about different types of therapies.
There's a book called the LDN book. Low-dose naltrexone is sometimes called LDN. And that has all the research and all the theory and case studies that anybody could want. And I have some case studies. I've seen absolutely dramatic, it's one of the most amazing medicines I've ever seen for autoimmune disease. I've treated even people with pemphigus who were bedridden for almost a decade, and now he's up and walking through this combination of diet and low-dose naltrexone. People with Graves disease, people with Crohn's disease, Hashimoto's. I tell people I couldn't pay my mortgage without low-dose naltrexone because so many of the patients who come to me now, I usually ask the patients, you know, what are you here for? And about 20% of them say, I'm here to get low-dose naltrexone.
Wow.
Because they heard it from somebody else and it changed their life.
Tell us a little bit more about it. So it originally started as another, for another reason, and it was found out, I'm trying to remember the whole story of it.
Basically a opiate receptor antagonist. So it started in the late 60s when there was a lot of heroin overdoses. So people found an antidote to a heroin overdose, which is a pure antagonist. In other words, heroin works on certain receptors and creates the euphoria and also respiratory depression. So naltrexone blocks heroin from connecting with these receptors, but it doesn't have any of the euphoria. And so it basically saves their life. So it's called Narcan. It's used in every crash cart, you know, 300 milligrams IV. You know, I used to be an ER doctor, and we used to give it if there was a heroin overdose. People would die. So that was great. And then they used it 50 milligrams orally to treat addicts. And two things happen. One is it blocks the high, which I guess is good. And the other thing is the people felt so bad, they said they'd rather be dead than take this stuff. And nobody knew why, but that led to the discovery of endorphins. So heroin is actually an exorphin or an exogenous opiate. And we're not born with heroin receptors, we're born with endorphin or endogenous opiate receptors called endorphins. And heroin, the poppy plant, has learned to mimic those endorphins and create a very strong effect, so apparently so people will grow it. It's a good strategy for the poppy plant, not so good for most people. But actually the failure, so when you were using 50 milligrams of naltrexone, you were blocking endorphins and people felt really bad. So that would have been the end of it as an addiction medicine. In fact, it's not a good addiction medicine. But it led to the discovery of endorphins. And then some people said, well, maybe endorphins have to do with the immune system, because people with opiate overdose or opiate abuse have a low immune state. And they found out that endorphins essentially run the immune system. So the question is, do people with poor immune function, autoimmune disease, have a low endorphin state? And the answer is probably yes. That's why they feel so lousy. So the next step was it's just a trick, really. You give somebody a very small dose of naltrexone, you block the receptors for an hour, you do it while they're asleep, you don't feel lousy because hopefully you're asleep, and then the body says, hey, somebody blocked my receptors, I need to make more endorphins. And you wake up with 100 times more endorphins, and suddenly you not only feel better, but your immune system functions more normally. That's how it works.
Fascinating. Fascinating. We're just about out of time. I'm just finding out all sorts of great information. As any of you that's listened to the show knows, that I'm just an information junkie on this subject. We're just about out of time. Tell us more about your book, how we can get it, and more about how we can find about your awesome work.
So the book is Vaccines, Autoimmunity, and the Changing Nature of Childhood Disease. I'm actually hoping that everybody buys it on August 14th on Amazon, because then apparently if everybody buys it on the same day, you get some sort of brownie points for that. and then writes a review, because the more reviews, the better. And what else did you, how to get in touch with?
Yes, your website.
So I have three websites. One is my practice, which is fourfoldhealing.com, fourfoldhealing.com. I wrote a book about the heart called Human Heart, cosmicheart.com. That's not the name of the book, but that's the website. And we also have a business selling vegetable powders called drcowansgarden.com, drcowans. garden.com. And I'm hoping not to create a new website about the vaccine autoimmune disease, but
Well, that's awesome. I mean, there's so many areas just hearing about your other websites where we could have gone with this topic, but thank you so much for sharing with us tonight about this, because this is very fascinating, and I encourage you all to do your own study, including getting the book and getting your own study to figure out how you feel on the subject. I know it can be a very controversial subject, but thank you for Dr. Cowan for sharing all of your research into the topic.
Okay, thank you.
Everyone, join me next Friday night for another episode of the Autoimmune Hour. And if you want to find any of the back episodes or transcripts, be sure and go to understandingautoimmune.com. You can sign up and get all the transcripts there, as well as we have some great guided meditations there now for you as well. And join us on Facebook at Life Interrupted Radio so we can continue the conversation on Facebook. Everyone, have a great weekend. Whatever your adventures, enjoy.
The information provided on lifeinterruptedradio.com is for educational purposes only. What you hear, read, and see on Life Interrupted Radio is based on experience only. The information presented here should never be used for any legal, diagnostic, or treatment purposes. Always seek sound legal, medical, and/or professional advice regarding any problems, conditions, and any of the recommendations you see, hear, or read here on Life Interrupted Radio. You've been listening to Life Interrupted Radio. To learn more, listen to other shows, and gain free resources that can help empower your life, be sure to stop by lifeinterruptedradio.com.
Do you want to be a better leader, have better relationships, become more self-aware, be a better communicator? Hi, I'm Sharon Saylor, best-selling author, professional speaker, and executive coach. And my life passion is empowering professionals to be the best that they can be. After years of working with professionals, I've discovered the 7 things nobody is telling you that can cost you your clients, sales, and even your career. And I want to give it to you free. You've heard my show, you know my passion, and maybe we'll be working together sooner rather than later. So go grab this ebook now to find out the 7 things that's costing you big time over at SharonSaylor.com/radio gift.
Research shows we apologize up to 10 times a day, and most of the time, we say sorry as a response to someone else's mistake. What if we thanked people instead of all that unnecessary apologizing? So instead of saying, sorry, I'm rambling, you say, thank you for listening. Join us at ProjectForgive.com, a free, non-religious resource on global forgiveness.